Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 20th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host today. We've just completed a most eventful week with crucial strategic developments on a number of important fronts. But what I want to concentrate on in this opening are two fronts which are really at the center of determining whether our civilization will survive or whether we go into a deep and prolonged dark age. First is the matter we've been covering week after week recently on the LaRouche Show, and we've highlighted especially on LaRouche Pack, on LPAC TV, Off the Cuff, and with the distribution of the first couple hundred thousand copies of our pamphlet, which is the fight to derail the Obama administration Nazi healthcare reform. There was tremendous breakthrough this week in that the cumulative effect of our mobilization, the mobilization of LaRouche PAC and the LaRouche Youth Movement, has forced a backdown from the Congress and caused a great deal of teeth gnashing within the administration. There are many excuses given, the question of budget overruns, public versus private. All of this is window dressing. Most of these are true. They're problems. But the real reason that this has been derailed is the intensity of the mobilization of LaRouche PAC to identify the Obama so-called reforms as nothing other than a Nazi policy. And this we have documented on the website. As a result of this mobilization, Obama himself was forced to go out front as the leading salesman, which makes him highly vulnerable. He's doing this at the potential expense of his own presidency, because if he succeeds in selling this, the country will go to hell. If we defeat him, he's either going to have to back off it and follow what LaRouche is saying, or he's finished as a front man for this British imperial policy. The second leading development, and this is very exciting, is the trip by Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche to Italy, where in a series of meetings with Italian legislators, an informal meeting in the Chamber of Deputies, which is the equivalent of the House of Representatives of the Italian Parliament, and then in private meetings with several leading Italian senators, Lyndon LaRouche not only revived his new Bretton Woods proposal based on the Four Powers Agreement, but laid out the basis by which a new renaissance can be brought into existence to defeat the global offensive on behalf of the Anglo-Dutch financial elite. Again, there's a full report on this on the LaRouche PAC site, including the transcript of the historic speech given by Lyndon LaRouche to the meeting the Chamber of Deputies. So again, if you want to be on top of this global strategic situation in front of the fight, it's the LaRouche PAC website that you need to basically, as one of my friends said, I live on this website. Well, this is the place you should live because this is reality. Today we're going to be looking at a new paper by Lyndon LaRouche, which he has described as one of the most important pieces he's ever done. It's titled Economy for Scientists, Economic Science in Short. And it attacks directly the fraudulent premises of all the policies coming from this administration and from the International Monetary Fund, the City of London, the British monarchy. In short, it devastates the ideological assumptions of the enemies of mankind. And I bring this up just to make one specific point. We had a series of follow-ups to the healthcare policy this week. For example, the so-called regulatory reform, which was completely fraudulent. But Larry Summers, Geithner, Orzag, and others are promising that there is a recovery coming. They see it. It's sprouting. It's moving into place. And really, they know it's a lie. But they're trying to save this system and at the same time move ahead to implement a Hitler-style fascist global regime that was based on that invented by the British for Hitler. Now, what Lyndon LaRouche does in this new paper is provide an in-depth investigation of the principles behind scientific discoveries, which are unique to human beings and have allowed civilization to advance. And what LaRouche has said is that if the forces behind the puppet Barack Obama with his Nero complex succeed, then civilization as we know it will die. So today we're going to take a look into this new paper, and joining me will be two members of the LaRouche Youth Movement who are presently assigned to the legendary basement, where they're working as part of a team directly under Lyndon LaRouche's leadership, which is looking into the most significant issues in science from the 18th, 19th, 20th, and now 21st century. What we'll do for today's program is we welcome emails with questions, but unless they're highly relevant and follow the flow of discussion, I'll just submit them to our two guests to answer in email form later. So if you want to ask a question, you can send it to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. But otherwise, I want to have an opportunity to have a full discussion with our two guests, Peter Martinson and Megan Roulard. So Peter and Megan, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Peter, you were interviewed on Off the Cuff the other, I think, evening, and you gave a very compelling summary of Lynn's new paper. So why don't we start with that? What is the basis of economic science, according to the world's most accurate economic forecaster, Lyndon LaRouche?
Yeah, well, he put out this paper because the number one big problem is that people who profess to understand economics and be the economists of the world actually, for the most part, don't know what they're talking about. Most of economics today is based on statistical interpretations of motions of money, motions of goods, denominated in money terms, and so forth. Mr. LaRouche makes the point that that's not economics. There are motions of money and so forth, but real economics is a focus on real economic profit comes from the development of the human mind and the development of the ability to make discoveries and develop new technologies based on those discoveries and to develop human culture around the concept of human creativity. And he hits at two types of personalities that you run into in human culture, particularly economics. One is the type of person who looks around and observes the universe and sees essentially a whole bunch of objects floating around in space around them. And that person's identity is that you assemble a list of how these objects around you interact with each other, and you create a statistical interpretation of what's going to happen next and so forth, and economic forecasts come out of that type of thinking, typically.
And that's the typical economist today.
Typical economists, who are, for the most part, wrong, like these behaviorists you were mentioning.
Yeah.
You think we're on the verge of the new recovery. But
they're not only wrong, they're completely incompetent. But go ahead. What's the second type of personality?
The other type of personality is competent, which is that you recognize that your sense perceptions are just shadows of being cast on your sense perceptions by principles that exist that you can't see with your senses, universal principles. And so the task of a true creative mind is to, yes, put together, you know, what's going on with what you're sensing, but then to adduce what the principle is that's creating those shadows. And LaRouche gives this a concrete concept. He calls it the tensor. And people might have heard of it. I don't know how many people have actually heard of the tensor who are involved in looking at things like Einstein's general relativity. But Mr. LaRouche makes the point that what Einstein was getting at with the tensor is just this. How do you represent the action of principles on all of your sense perceptions and then all the other instruments of measurement that human beings have created up till now? how do you represent the activity of those principles on our senses so that we can then act backwards and use those principles to change the universe?
Okay. Now, I have a question for you, and then I want to bring in Megan for her thoughts on this new paper, just as an opening of the subject. But clearly, there is, when in the two types of personalities that Mr. LaRouche describes, there's an idea of science which doesn't really exist so much anymore, which is that you can ultimately come to know with some degree of accuracy or truthfulness the principles that underlie what we see. Most modern science seems to reject that. Would I be wrong in that assumption?
No, that's absolutely true. Today, the things like art, classical music, are looked at as just, the stuff that just emotional people who can't handle the hard, cold realities of science go into. But, I mean, LaRouche points this out, and it's obvious to anybody who's ever done real science. Like if you look at people like Einstein and Planck, real scientific insight comes from immersing yourself in the development of classical forms of art, like music, like poetry, which are also investigations of how the human mind interacts with ideas, which are also nonsensical objects. And so you look at someone like Einstein, the guy would pick up a violin every chance he got. He would play in symphonies and things like that. That was his other main passion besides the science. And I think most of his insights in the science came from the fact that he was so immersed in classical culture. And if you know anything about Planck almost became a composer and a conductor of symphonies himself, but he went into sciences instead. With his other passion was classical art.
Well, we'll
so LaRouche, go ahead.
I'll say we'll be coming back to this question because this is at the heart of the paper. This interrelationship of the creative mind in looking at science and classical art. But I just want to pursue this question of truth one step further. If the idea of science is a search for truth, and LaRouche asserts that there is an economic science, as opposed to what they mainly teach now about economics being the dismal science, that is something that's unknowable. LaRouche argues that you can know the effects of policies in advance, and that that's what forecasting is. Wouldn't it follow then that what we've seen in the last several years, the complete lack of forecasting outside of LaRouche of this present breakdown crisis, wouldn't that in itself make the point quite obvious that modern economic science is not science but mere opinion, and often opinion for the purposes of policy changes?
Yeah. Anybody who says that you can't know the effect of a policy change is either dumb or lying. Most of the policy changes in the past 30, 40 years have been with the intent of reducing the world's population down to less than 2 or even less than 1 billion people on the planet. And the healthcare policies and so forth being pushed by the administration now are just another step in that direction of this fight between the British Empire and the United States. Are we going to have a world that's dedicated to improving the or defending and improving the development of human individuals so that they can make discoveries and make breakthroughs? Or is there going to be a world dominated by this idea that human beings are really just sense objects, a bunch of animals that we need to reduce and cull the herd so that a small minority can control them?
Megan, I'd like to bring you in now to get your sense of what you got from this new paper. I know you've been working on these ideas and the question of perception versus reality. What, in a brief summary, what struck you about the direction that Lyndon LaRouche took in this new paper?
Well, I think the one thing that really stuck out, which was already brought up, was this fundamental point he was making about the identity, the self-conception of a scientist, for example. What exactly is this distinction between these two types of identities? And I think a really good a good example or another way to look at it is one that a story LaRouche has told about himself being a young student in, you know, junior high or elementary school in a geometry class. Because the two identities he's talking about, one is, and he joked about this yesterday with some of us, is, you know, an idea, and in the paper, of sort of, you have empty space and objects floating around in it, and you also think of yourself as just one of these objects floating around in space. You can sort of bump up against things. You know, the scientist who has this identity really doesn't see his role as anything other than, you know, taking precise measurements and describing the other objects around him. So LaRouche talks about being in this geometry class when he was younger, and the teacher said, you know, what's the definition of a circle? And all of the other students, right, would have responded, well, you know, it's, you know, some point, and you have a radius from that point. And if you rotate that radius, the shape you'll get is a circle, a geometrical description. But LaRouche answered first in the class, and he said, well, you know, I was at Charlestown Navy Yard, and you have support structure beams which have circles cut in them, and this makes these structures stronger. So that's what a circle is. And he talks about everybody sort of laughing at him and making fun of him. But there's a certain subtle, there's a subtle difference in terms of his own self-conception, which is not just sort of passively, you know, sitting in empty space and describing things around him, but a sense that he is part of a physical universe that he could understand and could actually figure out how to change that physical universe. How to create, you know, make new creations, develop technologies. I can sort of see that seed there in terms of how he talks about himself as a young person.
What sort of a circle is a dynamic function as opposed to a definition which includes points and extension?
Right. Right. And I think, just in terms of the way this type of identity he's discussing, how this relates back to economics, and why is it that LaRouche is such a successful economic forecaster, really completely alone in that sense, in terms of, you know, he said there's other people who have certain competencies, but in terms of the record he has as a forecaster, that just doesn't exist. And it does have to do with this question of figuring out the sort of, space in which events are actually occurring, which is determined by space, which is determined by historical processes, for example, which are thousands of years old. He discusses in this paper the history of the principal empire and the different forms that this has taken throughout history. But the dynamic effect this has had upon the thinking of populations, European populations versus the American population, and looking at the way this is defining a certain space, you could say, or geometry, in which you can forecast or talk about the predictability of certain types of events of happening, whereas everybody else is looking at, you know, maybe minimally, they're looking at how did the unemployment rates last week, this week they've improved a little bit, so therefore we can extrapolate that and say that we're in a recovery. It's completely ridiculous. They're almost disregarding the entire rest of the universe, looking at one fact and trying to extrapolate something, and they just always end up being wrong.
Or how can we use lying statistics to cover our asses because our policies aren't working?
Right, exactly.
Well, Let me just remind our listeners, this is the LaRouche Show. We're taking up a very deep topic today that with both Peter and Megan. I mean, Peter's been in the basement for several years now. He doesn't get to see the light too much. He's grown a beard. Hopefully Megan hasn't grown a beard, but I wanted this topic on the air today because the paper is available on the LaRouche PAC website. And we're taking on a fight with this battle to defeat the British efforts to control the United States and destroy the United States through using the Obama administration. And these are not matters of opinion. There are ways to know scientifically why LaRouche is right when he identifies Obama's health care reforms as coming from the same outlook of man that led to the Nazi genocide in the 1939 through 44 period, 45 period. So we're going to be taking up some deep topics, and I'd encourage people to take the opportunity to read the paper and engage in discussion with it. This is how you create the philosophical improvements and cultural improvement in the country that can enable us to not just win this battle, but actually launch a new renaissance. Now, Peter, let me come back to you because you were the one who brought up this question of the two types of personalities. And the first one was essentially what would be described as an empiricist, someone who believes in the senses. Now, Lynn talks a lot about the role of Euclid. What is the relationship between Euclid and sense perception? And why is it that Euclid, the promotion of Euclidean geometry, is part of an imperial strategy for destroying the population?
Well, most of the, if you've ever, I mean, Euclid was some guy, maybe a bunch of people, back in ancient Greece. What Euclid wrote down were the results of a lot of breakthroughs that were made by the Greeks from doing observations on the oceans while navigating from continent to continent. Hundreds, thousands of years before Christ, these breakthroughs that were made in celestial dynamics were then codified and put into a book by Euclid or whoever this was, along with a set of rules for construction and other assumptions, which, if you read through Euclid's book, there's absolutely nothing about astronomy in there at all. It's all the constructions come from an initial number of rules, axioms, and definitions, which the original discoverers didn't have to make. So instead of actually communicating how the discoveries were made, because the discoveries actually increased man's power to exist, we were able to navigate the ocean, we were able to investigate new continents, we were able to make farming possible. We're able to start making larger and larger structures and supporting a larger population through the types of discoveries, the results of which were ripped off by Euclid. Instead of teaching people how to make those discoveries, Euclidean geometry, which is still taught up until today, Euclidean geometry teaches people that actually new discoveries are not possible. You have to derive everything that you might even think is new. You have to show that it's derivable from initial ideas which are already known, which means that you have to prove that your discovery actually is not a new discovery, but it was already known implicitly. So, which means that there is actually no creativity.
So that would now, that would tend to suppress people making new discoveries.
Yeah, that's the point. If you're an oligarchy and you want to control the population the way you control your cows, you don't want those people to think of themselves any higher than your cows, which means you want your cows to continually think about just eating grass and finding new patches of grass to eat, and that's it, and maybe making new cows. You don't want your population to be thinking about how to develop a better form of government, or maybe some of the policies that are being promoted by your king or queen are actually damaging to your population. You don't want your population using their mind scientifically or developing their minds through the creative arts, through the classical arts.
Well, Peter, from your study over the last couple of years of the history of scientific discovery, why is it then that Euclid becomes hegemonic for whole centuries, and this process of discovery that led to these led to the geometrical constructions. How come that's thrown out? How does that function?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that Greece was thrown into war, which destroyed the golden age of Greece. It was manipulated into it by a set of empires led by the Persians and so forth. And then it continued into Rome. So you had the population thrown into wars. So people are thinking about, you know, survival and how are they going to get the other guy and so forth. And people are taking less and less time doing real scientific work. So it becomes easier to suppress real creativity and teach instead just a set of rules to your students to have them memorize the rules. And then you didn't really have a resurgence of serious creative work in Europe until the Renaissance came along, and Cusa began reviving the methods of the Pythagoreans and the predecessors of Euclid. He started reviving what's called anti-Euclidean geometry. But later on, one important thing to know is that when Gauss was getting into the scientific scene, one of his secret studies was what he called anti-Euclidean geometry, which was different than non-Euclidean geometry. Non-Euclidean geometry is taught today as if non-Euclidean geometry is, you know, better than Euclidean geometry. But it's really just the same thing. Non-Euclidean geometry is just another geometry with a different set of rules, axioms, postulates, and so forth. But what Gauss was looking at was, can you develop a type of geometry which uses discovered universal principles as whatever the rules of the geometry? Can you actually use the universe? Can you discover how the universe functions and discover the geometry of the real universe without coming up with a set of false assumptions to just describe your senses? And he felt that he had to be super secretive about this, or else he'd be persecuted and probably killed by the Napoleonic regime.
So the attempt to develop an anti-Euclidean geometry was hazardous to his health.
He definitely thought so.
Yeah. Well, now, this then gets at the point. I had a discussion with an economist the other day who was quite upset about LaRouche's constant references back to Euclid and Kepler, and he said, why can't LaRouche just say, here's how I look at developments with the economy today, and here's why I know my forecasts are accurate? That is the unwillingness to look at underlying assumptions. Now, Megan, in the work we're doing in the basement, virtually everything we do is to investigate underlying assumptions, isn't it?
Right, yes. And I mean, I think whoever your friend was that said that, I mean, it also just, I mean, that would just be silly, because it gets back to this issue of the identity. That the point is, LaRouche has had a certain type of identity where he rejected Euclid and arbitrary authority from a very young age, which, you know, that he, you know, he developed out of that young person. And the point that I think he's been making is that these other economists, it's not simply a question of, you know, or people in Congress of giving them a bill or something, you know, with sort of steps of what to do, but there is a question of a shift in identity and a type of identity which challenges, is able to seek out and challenge and find what are the embedded assumptions involved in your own thinking. I think what Peter was discussing about Gauss and this search for an anti-Euclidean geometry is a very good example. I mean, you have somebody like Gauss, who's a very, you know, profound scientist and mathematician, who's involved with a discussion with other scientists and mathematicians about, you know, how do you prove or disprove Euclid's parallel postulate, which, you know, I think it's a worthwhile thing for people listening to go and you can find some of the correspondence that Gauss had with others about this. And it's a very challenging thing because something like the parallel postulate is something that, you know, you may not realize it, but it's one of those things where you say, well, this is just sort of self-evidently true. You know, give me a break. And this issue of making a certain shift in your own thinking about what does it mean to figure out the geometry or the shape of the actual physical universe that you're living in and not a sort of fictitious universe where you can, you know, prove certain theorems on a piece of paper. That's really, in a sense, what a physical economy is. You're looking at a space that's defined by certain physical principles. That's really the domain in which people's thinking needs to be, you know, effective economists or just plain citizens who have a correct sort of identity, self-conception, I think.
What I'd like to do is bring in the discussion then that Lynn has of Vernadsky and the importance of Vernadsky, because what we're getting at is to what extent is science an investigation of the mind in relationship to the physical universe around us. So where does Vernadsky fit in on this? Why is Vernadsky so important, Peter, to Lyndon LaRouche's thinking?
Well, Vernadsky's important to all of human science also. Mr. LaRouche looks at Vernadsky because Vernadsky made a serious scientific breakthrough. He made two major breakthroughs. One was the discovery of how the biosphere works, that there actually is a principle of life which does not function in the same way as principles of regular physical chemistry, non-living principles. But then nearing the end of his life, he recognized that human activity represented a higher principle than even life or the lithosphere, the non-living principles. He called it the noosphere. Now, LaRouche has been pointing recently at a criticism that Vernadsky laid against Einstein. Vernadsky thought that Einstein was a really sharp guy, a genius, and he actually collaborated with a lot of the same people that Einstein talked to. But he essentially said that Einstein's conception of space-time is good because it poses the problem that you can't separate space and time, but it does not take into account the fact that time and space don't exhibit themselves the same way in biological processes as they do in non-living processes. For example, in life, you can't go back and forth in time. Like evolution of creatures on the planet Earth always go one direction towards higher and higher modes of development, like leading to humans, for example. But in Einstein's conception of space-time, time is essentially just back and forth, another, like, the fourth dimension coordinate of space. Now, LaRouche makes the point, and I think this is actually an advancement on Vernadsky's conception, that time and space actually represent themselves differently in cognitive processes as well. Like, in cognitive processes, you do have a special type of time reversal where you can bring discoveries back from generations before. You can revive ideas that were developed hundreds of years before and re-intervene them into society today and then develop on them, as if developing the implications of someone's discovery which was made even thousands of years ago. So Mr. LaRouche is saying that we need to look back at Vernadsky for a conception of how to look at not just living processes, but also how to look at space and time as represented in cognitive processes.
Would it be fair to say that in that concept of space and time, that when you rediscover these principles and apply them, you are, in effect, changing the past as well?
You're changing the significance of what happened in the past. Absolutely.
Yeah. So this conception of time reversal is also important in terms of economic processes.
Yeah, exactly. For example, you take some of LaRouche's forecasts, just forecasting in general. You're forecasting a future state of the economy, which is conditional on the policies that are either passed or not passed today in terms of the economy. But if you, like, say, Mr. LaRouche is calling for example, a four-powers agreement between the United States, Russia, India, and China for the development, for the investment into the development of large-scale basic economic infrastructure projects. Now, you can make that kind of proposal, and you can, when the four-powers agreement gets moving, then you can start to look at what types of resources do we have to develop the to develop these types of infrastructure. Where are the resources? Like Siberia is, it's, you know, quote unquote, a gold mine of resources that have not been developed. But as you start developing them faster and faster, then you actually have to go back and change your forecast, because you'll actually be depleting resources more quickly now that you're using them to develop them more quickly. So in that sense, you're actually changing the future by making the forecast and making the policy. So then you have to come back and change your forecast again. So you have to have a continuously changing policy.
Isn't that pretty explicit in Vernadsky's discussion of biogeochemistry, that the idea of looking at the three phase spaces is oriented toward increasing the power of the noosphere, for example, developing Siberia?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was explicit in Vernadsky's political work, too. He looked at what he was doing on the biosphere and the noosphere as he saw the political work as part of his development of the biosphere and the noosphere. For example, he was one of the crucial figures in developing the Russian nuclear program. He was one of the main people that pushed it forward. He was very active in the government. And a lot of his research activities were dedicated to things like the development. He has most of his papers that he wrote are almost like catalogs of the amount of different types of elements that are present in the Earth's crust and where they exist. And then out of that, he actually develops a history of, he says that biogeochemistry is actually a history of is actually the geological history of the Earth's development. And so he looks at something like the development of resources in Siberia or the development of nuclear power as the next step in the development of the history of geology.
So then in this sense, man's mind becomes a geological force, as Lynn once put it. Peter, I'd like, before we go on to the question of the relationship of science and classical art, just to follow up this point with you. This Vernadsky tradition is still alive to some extent in Russia and Ukraine, and recently Sky Shields from the basement had an opportunity to participate as a representative of Mr. LaRouche in a conference on Vernadsky in Ukraine. What was his, from your discussions with him, what was his impression of how alive this tradition is and how important Mr. LaRouche's intervention has been to keep this tradition alive?
What Sky found was that we need to increase our organizing presence in the Russian world immediately, because the tradition is there. For example, you have a Russian Academy of Sciences where people are studying Vernadsky actively. One of the people that Sky talked to while he was out there was a Vernadsky expert. He was the guy that gave them a tour of Vernadsky's hometown in Ukraine. But what Sky found is that they are experts on Vernadsky, and they're very excited about Mr. LaRouche's ideas. But then they also have wrapped up some other crazy assumptions, which would be, which means that we need to be present there organizing. We need to develop our presence there as soon as possible. And Sky definitely thinks that the core of the organizing is LaRouche's perspective of Vernadsky.
And this then gets right at the question of the British deployment now into Russia to get the Russians to move against the dollar, as opposed to LaRouche's idea of bringing Russia, India, and China into a new Bretton Woods four powers agreement with the United States.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so the scientific question and the economic question are one and the same. This is the LaRouche Show. We're having a discussion with Peter Martinson and Megan Roulard on the work that they're doing under the direction of Lyndon LaRouche in really transforming science in the United States and worldwide by taking up these crucial questions. On today's program, we're looking at, and of course in a 45 minutes, 50 minute discussion of this sort, unfortunately you cannot get as deep as you need to into this paper, but the new paper of Lyndon LaRouche is available now. It's up on the website, Economy for Scientists, Economic Science in Short. And before I go back to Megan, let me simply say that if you understand, the listeners, if you understand the importance of this work, this is what the LaRouche Youth Movement is doing as its primary activity, taking these ideas from Mr. LaRouche and applying them in the real-time political fight today to defeat the British directed fascism of the Obama administration and restore this country to its constitutional traditions, which come out of the scientific outlook through the work of Franklin and others in developing our Constitution. So you can support this work by contributing to LaRouche PAC, not just going on the website and being a consumer of our ideas, but to make sure that you're an active part of developing and expanding precisely what Peter just described. For example, the reach of LaRouche's ideas into Russia. That takes funds. It takes support. And so be sure to go to the LaRouche PAC website and contribute today. Now, Megan, let me come back to this question that we sort of tantalized people with at the beginning of the program, this relationship between that Lynn writes about extensively in this paper, the applied physical science, acting with the mind upon subjects other than the human mind, and then classical modes of art, where he said that the subject of classical modes of art is man's willful change in the quality of human behavior as such. What is this interrelationship then? We know that Einstein was a musician, that many great scientists, at least in the past, were musicians. But what is the actual dynamic relationship between classical art and physical science?
Well, it's funny. LaRouche, in a meeting with some of his associates this morning, he said he was discussing this need for both of these elements to develop the full personality of someone. And he said, science without art is a body without a head. Art without science is a head without a body. Really need both. One way to discuss it just very directly, which I think is, I mean, this is the way in which our scientific work is just extremely different, because as Peter was discussing in the beginning, the tensor is something people associate, maybe people who are a little bit more familiar with Einstein, or just the history of science in general. It's associated with Einstein, with relativity, and the sort of mathematical expression. And LaRouche has been emphasizing that no, it's actually not that. And has been discussing it in terms of even musical composition. So, I mean, one thing, I know you probably have some interesting ideas about this, but Peter had given a class last night where he also threw out this idea of the relationship between the idea of a tensor and something like a fugue. So just to clarify a bit, just what one simple way to look at the tensor in science is you're looking at different sense perceptual readings, contradictory sense perceptual readings, or just different types of sense perceptual readings you're getting of some physical phenomena you're trying to figure out, whatever it may be. You can use just the simple example of like the curvature of a surface, for example. And you're trying to use these different readings to put together a picture of what is the actual reality of the thing that you're looking at. That is none of these readings, individual readings per se, but it's something higher, and that is only something which the mind, you need a mind, a creative mind, to conceptualize that. And I would argue you also need a mind with a certain aesthetic sense of, I think the way Kepler uses this type of method in his Harmonies of the World, where you're looking at the solar system from the standpoint of hearing and vision, and Kepler, you know, constructs this idea of how the solar system was created, that the creator had in mind human beings who created and could compose music. So I think one thing is just this aesthetic sense, a certain sense of beauty, which is involved in making this jump from what's all the sort of data that you're getting from your experiments, and then, well, what's the actual picture of the real universe you're looking at? Even something like the, refraction, the work that Fermat did on light, where you have this funny phenomena of light both bending, seemingly bending, but not actually being bent. And Fermat discovers the principle of light taking the least time path. But there's a certain sense of that which is efficient but also beautiful, I think, involved in that. So that's one thing. But then I think the other more direct way to look at it is something I was thinking about, is if you have something like a quartet. We've been working here, for example, on the Art of the Fugue. That's the one I most have been working on the most recently. And you look at the way you have four voices there, and the way in which, we've done some experiments looking at the relationship of two voices in, for example, like the Contrapuntis one, where you can get a certain idea of the piece looking at the relationship of two voices, but then you get a completely different conception of what Bach's idea was when you bring in maybe a third voice, which has a very, there's a certain part in that piece where the third voice is doing something totally different with respect to the other two, and it gives you just sort of a more, there's a more jarring sense of what Bach is doing in there. So I think there's a relationship between this issue of taking these different readings from your sense perceptions, figuring out what the physical universe is, and trying to actually figure out a musical idea in a composition, looking at the use of different voices reflecting on the same idea in different ways.
Well, in music in particular, you have both the what you might call the scientific or natural aspect of music, which is vocal registration, bel canto singing, the different species of the voices, and then putting them together in polyphony. That exists as, you might say, a natural scientific foundation. But then you have the question with Bach of the artistic, the creative use of those physical properties. And I think that's where you begin to see this interrelationship.
Right, and just the funny fact, just the idea of something like four-voice polyphony, that this isn't just some sort of arbitrary construct or something that we invented where there's no reason for it. There's actually built into the human population, you have different voice species, right? Even, you have the man's voice, the woman's voice, but then you have subspecies within those. So there's sort of a built-in potential to create polyphonic music, which is, that's just something interesting in and of itself, that's how things worked out.
Well, I know also that you've taken a look in the basement at the interrelationship between Bach and the development of the well-tempered musical system, and the fact that he lived in an area that had been the the domain, you might say, of Leibniz before him and then Kepler before him. And Peter, I know that this is something that is when in the basement, when people hear about the basement and they have this mystical idea, how do you go about investigating these things? What kind of work are you doing right now, for example, both in science and music?
Well, for one thing, you've got to sing it. Several of us are working on, we have a quartet. You look at Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, which is, he has two books. There's 48 pieces among the two books. He goes through all the keys, and it's written ostensibly for, a clavier, a type of piano back in the 18th century. But Lyndon LaRouche's, he gave us the challenge of mapping this out, but not from the standpoint of playing it on a piano and finding out how you work the piano, but from the standpoint that Bach's breakthrough is that you have no such thing as instrumental music. You have voices, like Megan is saying. And so what we're doing is taking Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier and we're scoring it out for four voice species, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and we're singing through it as a quartet to find out what are the interrelationships. And it's actually interesting, we're putting poetry with it too, because you can't just sing on ah the whole time. So we have to figure out what poetry will fit the music the best, but then at the same time that we're investigating how the poetry works, we're investigating how the piece works, and we're looking particularly right now, to begin with, at the C minor fugue from the second book of the Well-Tempered Clavier.
Right.
And we're trying to figure out how is it that the voices work to communicate the idea as a whole, because it wouldn't work if you removed one of the voices, and we tried these experiments.
All right, and how does this, let's bring it back to this question of economic science. How does working on polyphony and investigating the mind of Bach, how does that give you an advantage when it comes to economic science, either Peter or Megan?
Well, one thing is just, I mean, I think an important element of economic science is just, I mean, and it's the lack of it is reflected in this healthcare policy is, recognizing a certain, something beautiful about humanity and the potential of humanity and the value of, you know, of an individual human life, which, I mean, that's what's directly being attacked in this healthcare policy, is that there's a certain, and LaRouche, he's elaborated this in a recent memo that he wrote on the website. I can't remember the name, but there's a certain disrespect, complete disregard for a certain divine quality in the human being, in the citizen, which is just, I mean, we're at the point now with this current administration and just the trajectory of the past, you know, couple decades where, you know, maybe it was easier to hide in past years, but right now with this healthcare policy, this is just out in the open, the fact that there's just a complete disregard for the human being as capable of creative acts, even into old age or, you know, when very ill. And this administration is sort of saying, well, you know, that's not how we think about you. We think about you in terms of, you know, how much each year of your life is worth. So in a very direct way, I mean, that is just being attacked.
Well, and that's why this fight is so crucial, because we cannot move ahead unless we defeat this healthcare policy and everything else that's coming down from the Obama administration. But just defeating it is not the ultimate solution. We have to transform, use the fight to transform the way people think about themselves. Now, I'd like to conclude. We have about little more than five minutes to go. And Peter, you brought this up, Megan also, the question of tensors. Now, Lynn has emphasized that the approach to tensors, that almost invariably exists in science is mathematical. Why is that? Just tell us what's wrong with that and how the work you're doing looks at redefining what people think about this principle of the tensor.
What I'd say on that is, one, you do have sense perceptions. All scientists, good or bad, are going to, you have to make measurements. You have your own sense perceptions, which act as measuring instruments, but then you also have another set of measuring instruments that we've built. So you are going to accumulate a mass of whatever data, which you have to arrange and investigate and so forth. And we, you know, mathematics, you use mathematics for that. It's really just bookkeeping. But then at that point, you have to split between the two personalities. On the one hand, you have what's represented by, for example, some of these accountants in Nazi Germany. When you think about Nazis, you usually think about the guys with the guns in the Indiana Jones show. But the, you know, a lot of the people who were prosecuted at the Nuremberg tribunals were accountants who stopped at this point of saying, okay, we've accumulated the data, now we're going to do the mathematics on the data and determine who gets to live and who gets to die. It's just accounting. It's, you know, we don't really have a grudge against these people. It's just how the accounting works. The other personality says, okay, we've assembled the data. We're not going to get any further by manipulating the data anymore. We now have to go to how we think when we're participating in something like classical music. And we have to look at what is the higher principle that's generating, for example, the fugue that we're listening to. What's the higher principle that's generating what the alto voice is singing? What's the higher principle that's generating what the bass voice is singing? And you look at the higher principle as it's reflected in the shadows that you're investigating. And so from what I can tell, the tensor is actually, the tensor is more than, there is a mathematical thing called the tensor, which is very useful and you have to get to know it. But the real tensor is not a math object. It really is how does the mind make sense of the shadows in terms of figuring out what's generating those shadows? And that's the real human aspect.
And when you talk about this question of the shadows, in a sense, we're going back, as in so many things, to the ancient Greeks, of course, Plato's allegory of the cave. This really is the fight in history between the effort to develop a human civilization and empires. Megan, we have just a couple minutes left. Do you have anything you'd like to add on this to this discussion?
Yeah, just, I mean, I would say you're completely right. And if you look at, you know, remember also the real nature of our enemy in this fight, which is why it's so important for people to support us and help us in what we're doing, is the British Empire. But if you look at, I mean, the way LaRouche, the reason why LaRouche has such a hatred for the British Empire is if you look at throughout history, the sort of areas which they've chosen to get involved in, you put together a picture of the British Empire as representing this Zeus-type, you know, a Zeus-type figure trying to suppress the ability of human beings to use fire in the sense of the story of Prometheus. I mean, this is what we're trying to revive in the work that we're doing and rediscovering, you know, great scientific discoveries of the past. But what we really need is, you know, a culture where the population, you know, has this type of self-conception, a creative self-conception, which right now LaRouche's point in his paper is that this has been suppressed for, I mean, really, you've had periods where it's been able to sort of resist the suppression, but this has been suppressed for thousands of years, and it's time to buck this system of empire so we can go to Mars, as LaRouche says in his paper.
So we can all be Prometheans. That's the, yeah. I think that's the issue that we're talking about. Well, Peter and Megan, I'd like to thank you for your participation today. I hope this has been enlightening to our listeners and would encourage them, inspire them to pick up the new paper from LaRouche, Economy for Scientists, Economic Science in Short, and in the meantime, apply these ideas to the political fight to defeat the Nazi economic policies that are being imposed, trying to be imposed by this administration. The good news is, if we do our job, they will not succeed. So this has been the LaRouche Show for Saturday, June 20th, 2009. Next week, there will not be a LaRouche Show because we have the webcast with Lyndon LaRouche, but we'll see you in 2 weeks, and tune in next week for Lyndon LaRouche's international webcast. Thank you and goodbye.